how things are going to be played out tonight. Ben will be doing a speech, which will be followed by Q&A. The Q&A is available for everyone in the house, but priority will be given to the orchestra, the parterre, then the following balconies. With that being said, if you are someone who disagrees with Ben or wants to challenge him, we will allow you to jump the line. That's how benevolent we are. So I personally guarantee if you have a gripe with him, you're going to get your chance. Finally, I just wanted to say a few words about our organization and what we went through to make this happen. The UBC Free Speech Club is a nonpartisan organization and committed to cultivating an open dialogue on campus where arguments are made with reason rather than rhetoric and personal attack. We cherish a diversity of opinions and seek to promote an open debate stage where political correctness no longer holds sway. This mantra, however, is not loved by all. There are a few groups at our school who don't understand it. They don't understand why there needs to be a free speech club. They think, well, nobody wants to go see a conservative speaker. And to that, I say this. The second we announced this event, we had radicals trying to shut it down. We had our posters vandalized, smeared with anti-Semitic remarks, and we had the AMS, which is our own student union, a union which prides itself on unity and goodwill, officially come out against this event. It's a good thing we aren't part of the union. So to those who say there is no need for a free speech club, look at the past 5 months. And to those who say that nobody cares about free speech on campus, look around. It's a full house. And on that note, it is my great honor to introduce Ben Shapiro.
Thank you so much. Well, love you too. It's wonderful to be here. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for spending your Halloween with me here. I thought of dressing up tonight as Elizabeth Warren, but then I realized that I didn't want to culturally appropriate her heritage. I'm just not white enough. And then I thought maybe I'd dress up as a Canadian, but I'm not nice enough for that. Well, thank you. That's nice of you. So, I want to begin by thanking the UBC Free Speech Club and the university, for what it's worth, for making tonight possible. I also want to thank security for ensuring that everyone can hear different opinions in a safe environment. No thanks, however, to some folks on the left who insist that the university should have canceled this speech. A particular no thanks to the UBC AMS, who are apparently very concerned that my talk will, quote, stoke intolerance and discrimination based on race, gender identity, and sexual orientation. They say that they fear that some students at UBC will feel threatened and targeted by my message. And then they follow that up by saying that they denounce all forms of violence and marginalization on campus, presumably not including marginalization of a mainstream conservative worldview. They're okay with that sort of marginalization. I have never, it should be noted, never called for incivility. I have never called for violence. But that doesn't stop anybody from accusing conservatives of doing exactly that. Stating facts, stating conservative opinions, that is not threatening. And if you believe that it is threatening, I have two words for you. Grow up. This is still a somewhat free society in which we all get to exchange viewpoints without running to the fainting couches. Now, I agree with the AMS that folks who wish to peacefully protest should do so. It'd be even better if they would come inside and then ask questions, as you heard right beforehand. We have a long Q&A session. It's my favorite part of the evening. And I always urge folks who disagree to go right to the front of the line so we can actually have some civil, nice conversation, discussion about issues that matter. But instead, the AMS is preemptively referring people to places like the Sexual Assault Support Center. Now, there are a lot of black marks on my resume, probably, but I do have a fairly clean record when it comes to sexually assaulting people. When I say fairly clean, I mean like spotless record when it comes to sexually assaulting people. So I don't think anyone's going to need to go to the Sexual Assault Support Center tonight. They say that people should go to Speakeasy, which I guess is for peer support and guidance in a safe space of non-judgment. I admit that this is not going to be a safe space in the sense that they mean it, since they mean safe from having your feelings hurt, and I believe that safety exists in a free country when you are allowed to express your opinion. They're also directing folks to SafeWalk, which is a transportation service accompanying students walking after dark. So, I don't know what they think I'm doing after this. This might be an overreaction, folks. No thanks also to Dr. Charles Menzies, who's an anthropology professor and Board of Governors representative, who said it was a bad choice to bring me to campus and mentioned the university's Policy 3 in objecting to my potential speech. Policy 3 apparently implements the BC Human Rights Code, which is as foolish and overbroad a piece of legislation as it has been promulgated in a purportedly free society. For folks who don't know, BC's Human Rights Code states a person must not publish, issue, or display, or cause to be published, issued, or displayed any statement, publication, notice, sign, symbol, emblem, or other representation that indicates discrimination or an intention to discriminate against a person or a group or class of persons, or is likely to expose a person or a group or class of persons to hatred or contempt because of race, color, ancestry, place of origin, religion, marital status, family status, physical or mental disability, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, or age of the person or that group or class of persons. No one is in favor of hateful speech, but this policy simply defines as hateful anything which is quote-unquote likely to expose people to hatred and contempt, which is utterly subjective. Now, they say that what they really mean is anything that would be a reasonable person would assess as likely to expose people to hatred or contempt. Unfortunately, the people who are going to interpret that law are all members of the political left who will determine that it is reasonably likely that any sort of conservative speech may in fact be likely to provoke bad action on the part of people who agree with the conservative. This is why in the United States, which I'm an American, so I get to say it, I believe is a superior country to your own. Okay. Making friends and influencing people everywhere I go. In the United States, we don't have such laws because such laws are violative of basic precepts of the First Amendment. Free speech precepts. We understand there's such a thing as hateful speech in the United States, but we also understand that the definition of something like hate speech is endlessly malleable and can be used by people in power to simply quash people with whom they disagree. In fact, the UBC policy goes further than the BC Human Rights Code. It actually bans activities harmful to a respectful environment, which is an amazing statement. These range from expressions of disrespect, such as rudeness and gossip. I mean, have they ever been on a college campus? To bullying or harassment. And then they define harassment as intentional or unintentional, which includes ostracism or exclusion of a person that undermines an individual's self-esteem. We must never undermine anyone's self-esteem. Deeply imperative. Again, this is rather overbroad. Speech codes do not end well for freedom of speech as a general rule, and a free people are going to have to grow a thicker skin. Again, this doesn't mean you should be uncivil. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't be a virtuous person. But when you start setting standards like no one must be offended, no one's self-esteem must be damaged, you are in for a hell of a ride. So tonight, here is my plan. I'm going to say a bunch of things that I think are simply facts, and then I'm going to state some conservative opinions, and we'll see if I get arrested. So here we go. You ready? Here we go. Yeah. This is a fact. There are two, count them, two sexes. Two of them, not three. Not three, not nine, not infinite, not attack helicopter, two. I know, horrifying. Women are women, men are men. Men cannot become women because we don't live in a magical land in which men can become women or vice versa. Men who believe they are women are not biological women. Transgender women are not women. They are biological men with a mental disorder. There are two sexes. People with a Y chromosome are almost universally male. People without a Y chromosome are almost universally female. The only reason I say almost is because there do exist tiny variations in the population with gender disorders, sexual developmental disorders. These folks are intersex. They may have primary or secondary sexual characteristics that do not match the presence of a Y chromosome. These are called genetic abnormalities. And this does not mean that there is a third phantom sex that exists somewhere out there. Why? Because the promulgation of our entire species is based on sexual dimorphism. The fact that folks are willing to completely subsume biology under the rubric of political correctness is complete idiocy and anti-objective truth. And indeed, it turns out, the transgender advocates claim that no evidence must actually be shown of intersex genetics. That's just a red herring. When they say that folks are transgender, they don't mean the person's intersex. They mean that a person who is fully biologically male, who believes that he is female, is actually a female. In order to achieve this particularly nonsensical combination, both in terms of biology and logic, transgender civil rights advocates create a new category from sex, and this they call gender. Now, gender, in this view, is about maleness or femaleness. That's an entirely subjective category, not linked to biology. It's a social construct. It's not linked in any way to biology. So, a couple of problems with this right off the bat, just in terms of internal logic. First off, stereotyping. Okay, so if you believe that there is a gendered female and a gendered male, you are assuming there are stereotypes that describe femininity and masculinity. Feminists would argue with that. Second, this actually presumes that there are only two genders, maleness and femaleness. And then there are mixes of those various characteristics. Okay, so if you believe that there are actually a bunch of different genders, or the gender exists on a spectrum, then you have to explain why there are 89 genders and not 7.1 billion genders. Because it turns out that every human being on planet Earth, all of them, have a different combination of feminine and masculine characteristics. So if gender is just your feminine or masculine characteristic, then you as an individual have your own individual gender, which means that the term gender has no meaning. Right? It's just called being a human. Most obviously, separating maleness or femaleness from genetic influence is scientifically illiterate. To say that a biological male is a gendered female is a basic contradiction in terms. A biological male may have feminine characteristics. He is still a biological male. We all know many men who are effeminate. We all know many women who are masculine. Okay, it does not mean that the woman is a man or that the man is a woman. That's just silly talk. Is transgenderism a condition from birth that is genetically encoded and unchangeable? Well, the argument would be, yes, people are born like this, they've lived like this all their lives. For a certain subset of the population, I'm sure that this condition is, in fact, genetic and unchanging. But let's remember that 80% of all children who supposedly have gender confusion grow out of it by the time they hit teenage years. Okay, is transgenderism a mental disorder? Of course it is. And it was defined as a mental disorder by the DSM until about 4 years ago, when politically correct doctors decided to switch the definition of mental disorder itself. So originally, a mental disorder was just anything that was obviously at odds with reality. And then they switched it to be anything at odds with reality that also causes depression. So in other words, if you are a schizophrenic, but it doesn't cause you some sort of difficulty in your everyday life, you are not mentally ill. Right? It's difficulty in your everyday life that we link to mental illness. Otherwise, you can believe that your head is a toaster, and if you're living a happy, fine life, then everything is hunky-dory, and you don't have a mental disorder. Okay. Transgenderism. Gender identity disorder, gender dysphoria. This is a form of body dysmorphia, just like anorexia or body identity integrity disorder. When you're anorexic, you are not fat. You believe you are fat. This does not mean you are a fat person. This means you are an anorexic. Okay, if you have body identity integrity disorder, you have two arms, you believe that you are a one-armed person in the body of a two-armed person. This does not mean you are actually a one-armed person in the body of a two-armed person. It means that you have a mental disorder. Now, the reason that I stress all of this is not to be mean. It is not. It's to be straight in our diagnosis. We would never treat any other disorder this way. My grandfather suffered from schizophrenia and bipolarity. He was treated with lithium. If society had simply decided, you know what, Nate, the radio is talking to you. The curtains are trying to strangle you. He would have been worse off. Not only that, when an entire society decides that it's going to redefine basic terminology about biological sex in order to make room for the sensitivity of a people of certain numbers of people who are suffering, you are doing great damage to the fundamental distinctions that lie at the root of society. Plus, you're confusing kids. Okay, you don't actually get to teach my 4.5-year-old daughter that she can be a boy. Okay, let's move on to some other facts that will probably get me arrested. Okay, fact number two. Radical Islamic theology is not a fringe proposition. A large number of Muslims across the world believe what we in the West would consider to be radical propositions about government, morality, and individual rights. This is not a rip on Islam as a religion. I am not purporting to be an expert on Islam as a religion. I would not purport to be an expert on Christianity as a religion. I have no interest in browsing Islamic texts or Christian texts or any other religious texts for evidence of violent intent. I am much more focused on how people think and how people act. So, let's begin with a couple of definitional facts. If Christians in the United States or Canada wanted to be governed by Christian theological law, we would call them theocrats and radicals. If Muslims want to be governed by Sharia law, this would make them fundamentalists and radicals. Here are the percentages of Muslims who want their country to be officially governed by Sharia law across the world, according to Pew Global Research. Russia, 42%. Indonesia, 72%. Afghanistan, 99%. Pakistan, 84%. Bangladesh, 82%. Iraq, 91%. Palestinian territories, 89%. Egypt, 74%. Jordan, 71%. Niger, 86%. Nigeria, 71%. Okay, those are all groups of people who believe that Islamic law should govern their country. How do I know that's radical? Because again, if you applied the same rule to Christians or Jews, you would believe that it was radical for a Christian or a Jew to believe that. But let's take an even better indicator. Let's take an indicator that I think we can all agree is even more radical than just governance of Sharia law. How about support for ISIS? Okay, right? If you support ISIS, I think we can all fairly agree you're probably radical. Here are the percentage of folks in various territories and countries who say they don't know whether they're favorable toward ISIS or are favorable toward ISIS. By the way, if you say you don't know whether you're favorable toward ISIS, you're favorable toward ISIS. In the Palestinian territory, 16%. Indonesia, 22%. Turkey, 27%. Nigeria, 34%. Malaysia, 36%. And Pakistan, a whopping 71% of people say that they either like ISIS or they don't know about, or they don't know. Which again means you like ISIS. How about support for suicide bombings? The vast majority of Muslims across the world condemn suicide bombings, but not in particular areas like the Palestinian territories. According to a 2011 Pew poll, only 19% of Palestinians said such bombings were never justified. Egypt, only 38% said such bombings were never justified. Now, distinctions must be drawn. Western Muslims are significantly more moderate than their co-religionists in other parts of the world. Okay, that is just a fact by every available poll. Still, a 2006 poll in Britain found that 40% of British Muslims wanted Sharia law in the United Kingdom. A 2011 poll from Pew found that 19% of American Muslims said they were either favorable toward Al-Qaeda or they didn't know. Again, none of this is meant to suggest that every Muslim is violent. I've said specifically many times in the past 3 minutes that that is not the case. None of this is to suggest that any Muslim that you know is a member of a radical group. That, of course, is untrue. None of this is to suggest that Islam as a religion is inherently violent, because I think you can look at a lot of religious texts and see violence there if you wish to see violence there. What this is to say is that to suggest that radical Islam is just a fringe thing affecting only a very small number of people is not true. It is not true, and it is anti-fascist. Actual. Okay, more facts that could get me arrested. Women are not widely discriminated against in Western societies. Women in the United States are not paid 77 cents for every dollar a man makes. That's just a bunch of bullshit. It's not true. Okay. Christina Hoff Summers, the factual feminist, writes, "The bottom line is that the 23-cent gender pay gap is simply the difference between the average earnings of all men and women working full-time. It does not account for differences in occupations, positions, education, job tenure, or hours worked per week. When you actually consider all of the relevant factors, the wage gap narrows to the point of vanishing. Actually, when you look at it, young childless women with the same amount of education in the same professions in America's major cities earn significantly more than men. According to a new analysis of 2,000 communities by a market research company in 147 out of 150 of the biggest cities in the United States, the median full-time salaries of young women are 8% higher than those of the guys in their peer group. Well, now, there are a few things that are kind of hilarious about discussions of the gender gap. Okay, some of the facts are really inconvenient for feminists who suggest that all of this is due to discrimination. So here are a couple of really, really inconvenient facts. First of all, societies that have worked to end the gender gap have actually created a larger gender gap. So, particularly this is true in the field, in STEM fields. So societies that are freer for women actually have fewer women by percentage in the STEM fields than societies that are less free for women and less prosperous for women. Largely because when women are free, a lot of them don't want to be in the STEM fields. Okay, women and men have different preferences as to which types of jobs they like to go into. Women tend to like jobs with a lot of other human contact. Men like to play with things. Right? Men are just over, they're like my 2.5-year-old son. They like to bang on electronic toys and shout at people. In the United States, 27% of students who took the AP computer science exam were female. In Algeria, okay, not exactly known for its pro-female policies, 41% of college grads in STEM were female. Across all countries, boys had relative strengths in science and math, girls have relative strengths in reading. Gender equality means that sometimes women make choices feminists don't like, and that undergird the basic reality that men and women are different at some fundamental levels. Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker explains differences between the sexes are part of the human condition. Okay, and this is also true with regard to how women and men perform with regard to math and science. What the studies tend to show is that men and women, on average, perform nearly identically in math and science, but that the bell curves are not equally shaped. The bell curves for men tends to be a lot thinner in the middle and a lot fatter at the ends. What that means is that men are either really bad at science or really good at science. Women tend to be, on average, just as good at science as men, but when you get out to the tail ends, those are skinnier. So that means that if you actually look at like the 99th percentile performance in math and science, or if you look at the 1% performance in math and science, a lot more men than women in that particular cohort. A couple of other facts. Talk of a campus rape epidemic. This is pure fantasy. This idea that women are every day walking on campus and are in danger, 1 in 4 women will be raped while they're on a college campus, it's just not true. And by the way, women, if you actually believe that were true, what the hell are you doing here? Honest to God, if I believed that my sisters in college were going to be raped, I would have gotten them the hell out of there as fast as humanly possible. Yeah, as Professor James Allen Fox of Northeastern University and Richard Moran of Mount Holyoke College point out, the estimated 19% sexual assault rate among college women is based on a survey at large four-year universities, which doesn't reflect colleges overall. Also, the survey had a large non-response rate with the clear possibility that people who were more victimized were more apt to actually respond. Also, a lot of these studies tend to include things that are not actually rape in the statistics. They'll say sexual assault, but what they actually say in the survey data are things like, did a man try to kiss you and you turned away? Where, frankly, I'm shocked that that number isn't 100% for women. Now, other inconvenient facts. When men or anyone else talks about the right to life for unborn children, it's not because they're sexist. It's because they care about babies. The biological fact is that human life begins at conception. End of story. That's when human life begins. Now, you can make a lot of excuses as to why you think that human life should be snuffed out at particular times in the pregnancy, but you cannot overcome that basic fact that a new human life is created at the point of fertilization. That is just a basic biological truth available in any biology textbook for the last 100 years. Everybody knows this, and yet we all ignore it in favor of ridiculous moral stupidities like the notion that you get to choose subjectively whether you think that a child is a child or not. Which is the same sort of logic, by the way, that was used with slaves. You get to choose whether a black person is a person or not for purposes of holding them as property. Or what Nazis used to say about Jews, you get to decide whether this is a human or a cockroach for purposes of killing them. You don't get to do that with other human beings, you don't get to do that with human life. At least face up to what it is that you're talking about and stop using euphemisms when you talk about abortion. More facts. Capitalism does not harm the poor. Capitalism makes... Capitalism makes the poor the richest poor people in the history of humanity by a long, long shot. As Pew Research points out, looking at the United States, the U.S. stands head and shoulders above the rest of the world. More than half of Americans, 56%, were high income by the global standard. Another 32% were upper middle income. In other words, almost 9 in 10 Americans had a standard of living that was above the global middle income standard. Only 7% of people in the United States were middle income. 3% were low income. Only 2% of Americans, 2%, were poor by global standards. And how about the idea that the rich people in Western societies aren't paying their fair share? Obviously, that is untrue. That is particularly untrue in the United States, where the highest income quintile is financing 96% of all net costs. And all the talk about the divisions between the 1% and the 99%, all of this is based on a couple of bad notions. One is that you should be deeply worried about what your neighbor makes. If your neighbor isn't stealing your silverware, you have no business caring about what your neighbor makes. It actually violates one of the Ten Commandments. You're not supposed to do that. Even God says so. You're not supposed to covet your neighbor's ass, which would be a good lesson for Bill Clinton. Or maybe... Or, to be bipartisan, Donald Trump. It is also true that when we talk about the 1% and the divisions between the 1% and the 99%, lots of people move in and out of the 1%. It is not a group of people who are born in the 1% and stay in the 1%. There are times in your life when you will probably be in the upper 1%. There are times in your life when you will not be in the upper 1%. People tend to get richer as they get older. They have more savings as they get older. They tend to have more earning power at certain times in their life. There's this weird notion that if you're in the 1%, you're screwing everyone in the 99%. Again, no evidence of that, and also no evidence that once you get in the 1%, you stay in the 1%. There's tremendous economic mobility in capitalist countries. Okay. Also, the root of poverty in the end in free Western societies has to do with personal decision-making. And now, that doesn't mean that where you're born doesn't have some impact on where you end up. Obviously, it does. It doesn't mean that it has no impact on the challenges you face in your life. But in a free capitalist society, you basically have to do three things in order to succeed to the point where you are not poor anymore. Everyone in this room is capable of these three things. You have to finish high school, you have to get a full-time job, you have to wait till you're married to have kids. Those three things, you won't be poor. According to the Brookings Institute, of American adults who followed these three simple rules, only 2% are in poverty, nearly 75% have joined the middle class. We're all capable of these three things. I mean, when people say that societal discrimination prevents you from making good decisions, I'm confused how societal discrimination forced you to have sex with that girl and then take off, or forced you to have sex with that guy out of wedlock and unprotected. Like, nobody was there with a gun to your head. If you did that, that's on you. Okay, that's not societal discrimination. The entire world would be better off if we all started to take a little more personal responsibility about the decisions that we have within our own control. Okay, a couple more facts. The vast majority of disparities in the United States are not due to ongoing discrimination. They are due to the after effects of historical discrimination and to invidious choices made by individuals. So when you see statistics about in the United States, the racial breakdown of people who are in prison, for example, that's because there is a differential racial rate of crime. That does not mean that you are inherently more likely to commit crime because your skin color is a certain color or because of anything else. Okay, it does mean that different people commit crimes at different rates. Okay, individuals within certain groups commit crimes at different rates. If we broke down this auditorium into quadrants, presumably it would not be an equal number of people who score the same on all the tests. Right, there would actually be disparities in those groups. Disparities does not mean discrimination. Okay, the Justice Department under Bill Clinton found that that black folks in the United States had a lower chance of prosecution than whites in 75 major American cities as of 1994, as early as 1994. A certain study from CUNY found that adjusted for the homicide rate in the United States, white folks are actually 1.7 times more likely than blacks to die at the hands of the police. In July 2016, Harvard professor Roland Flyer, who happens to be black, surveyed over 1,000 police shootings, found black suspects are actually shot less often than white suspects in comparable situations. Okay, so a lot of the disparities that you see in American society are, again, caused by folks making bad decisions at differential rates. And some of that is due to historical after effect. Some of that is due to, yes, a legacy of slavery and Jim Crow, and a lot of that can only be broken out of thanks to personal decision-making like don't commit a crime, don't have babies out of wedlock, finish high school. These are all things that are within people's control, and to attribute them to societal failings is to ignore the fact that in a free country, your life is under your own control. So, here's the conclusion. Virtually everything that I just said, there are a lot of facts and a lot of figures there. Virtually all of those things were objective facts. I then drew conclusions from those objective facts. Now, you can argue with the conclusions that I draw, and you can argue with the facts if you can bring a set of competing facts to argue with those facts. That is fine. But if you are going to label my viewpoint racist or bigoted, if you are going to label conservatism racist or bigoted, if you're going to label facts inappropriate for a broad audience to hear, well, then you are quashing free debate. You are quashing free speech. This basic idea is too much for some folks. Some folks are already so deeply offended they feel no need to actually offer an argument. Instead, they just suggest that I'm being offensive, that I'm somehow making light of their truth. Okay, one of the most invidious phrases in human history, your truth. There is no thing as your truth. There is just the truth and your opinion. We can't have a common conversation without a common basis of fact. And that's why I at least try to show my work here. So here's what I hope for the rest of the night and for our debates in general. That the other side of the aisle shows its work. The other side of the aisle brings its own facts. The other side of the aisle explains why the facts that I've cited are insufficient to support the conclusions that I've made. That we argue from common premises and that we don't attack each other's character simply over disagreement or suggest that hate speech means that I can't express my opinion. If facts offend you, tough. In a free society, you're going to have to hear them. Because, of course, facts don't care about your feelings. Thanks so much. You know, I actually am having on Stephen Harper on the Sunday special next week. So that should be fun. I have to admit that the first time I met Prime Minister Harper, I went up to Ontario. We were doing a Sun News hit back when Sun News was a thing. For the 2012 election. And so I went and I met Prime Minister Harper, and this is when Barack Obama was president. And I will admit that I went up to him and I said, so when can you guys invade? And he said, doesn't that make you a traitor? And I said, not if you win.
All right, Mr. Shapiro, we have our first question over here.
Hi, Ben. Big fan of your work. My name is Fiona. Just a little concern about what you said regarding people having individual choice, which I believe is very important. But I think in today's society, I see a lot of men and what they go through is a lot of injustice from the legal system, especially in family law, because it's very disadvantageous for men. So I was wondering, would you consider that as a structural issue, especially today when you see there are women who make false allegations against men, and then the legal system just kind of believe women. So what do you say about that?
Sure. I mean, whenever there's a violation of due process, so the basic philosophy that I espouse and that was espoused by the founders of the United States, again, we should have annexed you guys. But the basic philosophy that I espouse is individual rights given by God, protected by limited government. And those individual rights extend to due process of law. The fact that we have overturned due process of law in certain areas of the Western canon and instead suggested that the burden of proof lies with the accused rather than with the accuser, and that we can simply adjudicate whether somebody is guilty or innocent based on their group identity, which is the most nefarious idea of all. The idea of social justice is deeply nefarious, at least modern social justice. This idea that I can determine whether somebody is guilty or innocent based on their group identity, that was the same excuse that folks used to use when they were stringing up black folks because they were racist and evil. So it is deeply disturbing to see folks embrace a group identity that is supposed to substitute for justice. And it's also deeply disturbing when folks decide to railroad somebody based on a lack of evidence, specifically because they have more sympathy for one side or the other in a particular debate. You don't get to do that.
So would you say that is a structural issue, though? That is.
Sure. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that every law that's ever been passed in the West is great. I mean, there are lots of crappy laws that I hate. And I will say that I think there are some structural issues that cut against justice and individual rights and basic human fairness.
Thank you.
Hi, Ben. I'm feeling the dragon energy in this room. I have a question as a Jewish person as well. I wanted to ask you something that we can relate to. One of the questions I have is today I had a vigil for the Pittsburgh massacre that happened recently, which was really sad for me, and of course you also felt it as well. But I noticed that at the vigil, a lot of the Jewish people were speaking up about intersectionality and being compassionate and being nice, and that's how we're gonna resolve all these issues. And I've noticed that a lot of like young American Jews also kind of abide by this saying and kind of avoid Israel and that kind of topic. So how do we get more Jewish young Americans, young Canadians to be interested in Israel and knowing that that's the only way we can defend ourselves? And yeah, and one more quick question. If the Democrats win the House in the midterms, do you think Trump will be impeached?
Well, I mean, as far as the impeachment question, I think they would be foolish to do it because they don't really have good grounds to do it, and so it would probably backfire against them in the same way. In the same way that it was bad for Republicans when they tried to impeach President Clinton back in 1998, when they did have pretty solid grounds for such impeachment. As far as talking about Israel, I think the first step to understanding Israel is to say that not every criticism of Israel or Israeli policy is anti-Semitic, but every anti-Semite that you know hates Israel. Okay, not all rectangles are squares, but all squares are rectangles. So the fact is that if you believe that Israel should be held to a different standard than any other nation, you're an anti-Semite. If you believe that Israel is the serious problem in the Middle East, then you're either ignorant or an anti-Semite. Those are the only two available options. If you believe that Israel deserves the same sort of criticism or more criticism than Iran or Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon or Egypt or Sudan or Yemen or any of the countless other countries in the region, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. As far as Israel's role in protecting Jews, I mean, it does make a difference that Jews have a country where they know that they will be protected. And also, it does mean that the rest of the world cannot necessarily, you know, target Jews without those Jews having a safe haven to go to. I mean, one of the big problems during World War II, obviously, is that Jews literally had no place to go. All the borders were shut to them. That is not true in Europe, where Jews have been leaving Europe pretty rapidly for Israel. So Israel is deeply important to Jews. It should remain deeply important to Jews, obviously.
Sorry.
Israel should remain important to non-Jews because it is a canary in the coal mine in the fight against Islamic extremism. It's the only democracy in the region. It's the only true ally that we have in the region.
Can I follow up really quick, too? I would ask, how do we get more young American Jews and young Canadian Jews energized about Israel? Because
I think that, to be frank, the care about Israel is very much connected to a certain level of religious observance. I mean, this is just what the polls tend to show. The more religious you get, the more you tend to care about the state of Israel. And the more irreligious you get, the more you treat Israel as most secular leftists would. And so if the question is about Jews, if you want to get Jews interested in Israel, you first have to get them interested in Judaism.
Happy Halloween, Ben.
Thank you.
So I have an issue with your stance on abortion.
Okay.
Right, so you define life as starting at conception through biology, pretty much. But I think you take the stance that life is intrinsically valuable because it's life. And that's where I disagree. I think there's two things that make life valuable. I think consciousness, the ability to experience pain, senses and stuff like that, and personal identity. In particular, psychological continuity identity. So the fact that we have memories, we have relationships, people have relationships to us. I think
Do you need both of those? Or is it neither or? I just want to clarify your position.
Either or.
Okay, so if it's either or, then people with Alzheimer's have real continuity problems. You can't kill them.
No, because people still have relationships with them, though, right? So like, just because
you have a relationship with them, but with people with advanced stage Alzheimer's, they really don't have a relationship.
Okay, but for the sake of example, like, let's say someone dies, right? The family gets to decide what you do with the body. Because I know what you say. When you say, someone says, oh, it's just consciousness, and then they're brain dead, you say, well, can you stab them? No, you can't. Because that's the family's decision what to do with the body. It's the person's decision what they want to do.
So if the family decides to stab them, it's okay to stab the
when they're brain dead? Yeah, if they want to pull
the... not brain dead. Let's say that you're comatose for a specifically and predictably short period of time. Say 9 months.
Say now, well, what is the person... Okay, yeah. No. I saw. So I would say on the legal grounds, it would depend if what the person put in their will. If the person has made clear statements like, hey, don't pull the plug on 9 months, then don't do that. Because I think the first choice is...
Right, but let's say the person has not made such clear statements. Say the person can't make such clear statements.
So that, and he's just in a complete coma?
Let's say the person has not drawn up a living will or had conversations like this. They're in a car crash, they get in a coma. You know that in 9 months they're going to come out of the coma and they're going to be fine. Are you allowed to stab? Can the family say, you know what, these nine months, stab the dude.
Wait, so they're fine, so they're going to get their memories back?
Let's say they don't get their memories back.
Then I would say then that person is dead. And yeah, if the family wants to pull the plug, that's fine. I would have no problem with that. Because that person is dead.
You're getting
dead.
Some dicey territory, dude.
No, I think that person is dead. Right? And that's the best way to define life, is personal identity and consciousness. That's what makes life valuable.
Right, so I think that, again, if you were to say both, that's too much. And if you were even to say either, I don't think either one of those legs stands on its own. Okay, because what you really mean, this is the thing about having a baby. It's a process of development. Right? And this is the point that I'm making. There's a period in this human life when that child does not have, or fetus or embryo, whatever you want to call it, when this living thing does not have consciousness and does not have a sense of identity. But in 9 months, it will have consciousness.
Well, by the way, babies
don't have a sense of identity for at least a certain number of months after they're born.
Babies can recognize their parents' voices after they're born.
That's not a sense of identity. Rats can.
No. I'd say it is because it's a form of memory, though. Right, and that's what I was using.
So are you a Jainist? Because animals also have consciousness.
I would say that killing animals is wrong. You have no problem with that.
So just to get this straight. killing Fluffy the hamster, deeply wrong. Killing a dude who's going to wake up from a coma in 9 months with memory problems, totally cool. Okay, I mean, that's fine. You can have that position. I'm just not going to put you in charge of the NHS.
All right, thank you very much for your question, but we have to move on.
Hey, Ben, how you doing? I was listening to Peter Boghossian on Joe Rogan today, and it just made me think of you because you were bringing some... you brought that up on your podcast before. I just think like the West is eating itself. I'm part of the Iranian diaspora, and your people and my people go back, and I sympathize with the Jewish people. I really do. I just think like I've been fortunate to travel around the world. I haven't seen this kind of nonsense and idiocy burgeoning anywhere else around the world. I mean, if you go to Thailand, they're not worrying about 72 gender pronouns, or Japan, or even Buenos Aires. Like, do you think that this is a problem of just the West and Western Europe?
Yeah, I mean, luxury breeds people creating new problems for themselves, no question. I mean, we're a very bored people. And we can create problems out of Halloween costumes.
So do you think clinging to a historical canon is a antidote to this kind of idea?
For sure. I mean, I think that pursuit of virtue, meaning kind of traditional Judeo-Christian values and a sense of objective truth and reason are necessary. It makes for a lot of hard conversations, as we've seen a little bit tonight, but I think that if we don't cling to a sense that truth is not merely a subjective construct, if we don't cling to the idea that there's such a thing as objective truth, we can't have conversations and we tend to eat ourselves. And it's also, navel gazing, which is basically what we've decided to do as a society, navel gazing and moral preening. Is a luxury that extraordinarily rich countries have, but everybody else still has to eat.
Thanks so much.
Hi, Ben. Big fan. My question is about climate change. So if I remember correctly, I heard you once say in a video that you do believe that human activity does have some sort of effect on the climate.
Yep.
So, one, I would just like you to explain a little bit of your understanding of climate change.
Sure.
And another question is, are there any government policies that you would support in terms to mitigate carbon emissions?
Okay. So my perspective on climate change is, number one, I'm not a climatologist, but accepting the IPCC reports, you have to take into account the fact that modeling has been wrong for 20 to 30 years. It's always been overestimating the amount of climate change that's actually taken place. But virtually every reputable scientist, including folks who are called skeptics, believe that the climate is warming. There's an argument about as to how much, and that over 50% of that warming is probably attributable to human activity. Now, that raises other questions, which is, okay, so let's say the Earth is warming. What kind of damage is that actually going to do? And this is a serious question, right? Let's say that the Earth is warming and we're causing it. Does that mean that it's the day after tomorrow and massive floods in New York and Dennis Quaid running around with Jake Gyllenhaal trying to avoid the freeze? No, it doesn't, right? It means that over the course of the next 100 years that the water level is going to rise a rather predictable number of inches or feet, and then humans will migrate based on those weather patterns as humans have done since human beings became human beings and started walking on 2 feet. I'm a little more sanguine about the possibility of long-term climate change than a lot of the catastrophists who seem to assume that there's going to be tremendous damage done. All the talk, for example, about the storms are becoming that more severe and they're doing that much more damage, the statistics really don't back that up. What they really back up is that we're just building more stuff in the path of hurricanes, that we're building more expensive stuff in the path of hurricanes. And so when the storms break that stuff, then it's more expensive for us to fix that stuff. Because the number of hurricanes actually hasn't changed markedly over time. And when folks say the intensity of hurricanes has changed, what they really mean is that the amount of cost associated with the hurricane has changed. As far as what should be done about that, well, the biggest problem that you have is a serious collective action problem. Let's assume that you really think that there's a huge problem. You still have to decide whether you believe what, let's put it this way, what level of climate change requires what level of cutbacks in terms of the global economy. So there's a fellow whose name escapes me right now who just won the Nobel Prize in Economics who legitimately made his entire career out of studying the economics of climate change. When does he think that intervention economically is called for? He says that until he believes that over the next century there's 3.5 degrees centigrade of climate change, that intervention actually would be counterproductive. It would cost more to intervene than it would to actually allow the damage to take place and just cope with it, because the economy is going to continue to grow over time. So I don't see any reason why I think that I would know better than he does. It's also a basic fact that the only countries that have really been abiding by any of the attempts to reduce climate change have been extraordinarily developed countries. Developing countries have no interest in sacrificing their own people at the altar of climate change. And the number one reducer in emissions over the past year was actually the United States. I mean, the United States pulls out of the Paris Accords. The Paris Accords, by the way, did nothing. They were completely useless. It was basically sign a piece of paper saying you don't like climate change. Okay, fine, I signed it, yay. And then everybody's like, oh, we solved climate change. No, you didn't. What does solve climate change is technological progress. And technological progress has led to a reduction in carbon emissions in the United States. It will not lead to a reduction in carbon emissions in developing countries for another 10 to 15 years, including places like China. So it's a complex issue, and all the folks who are basically like, let's just kill capitalism. And good luck with that.
Thank you.
Hi, Ben. My name is JJ. I just wanted to ask you a question on a topic that I've never heard you address before, and it's an issue that's kind of big in Canada as well as the U.S., and that's the issue of Indian reservations. I was just kind of curious as to what your general perspective is on them. At a philosophical level, do you think they're good or bad things? Do you think they should have more power or less power? What's your just general take on them?
So, I mean, this has been an issue a little bit in the United States, obviously not to the same extent as it has been in Canada. I will know a little bit about Canada, but not a tremendous amount. So I'll speak in the U.S. context, which I know a little bit better. When you sign a treaty with a group of folks who you forcibly expelled from their land, it seems to me only fair to allow them to govern their land as they see fit. With that said, I think that we should make it a lot easier for folks to leave Native American reservations if they want to. I don't think that we should be forcibly taking children out of non-reservation areas and returning them to reservations, as has happened a couple of times in the United States. I think with freedom of movement and trying to offer more opportunity to folks inside reservations, I think that a lot of those folks would be better off leaving those reservations. But that's an individual choice for them to make. I think that delegating that authority down to the local level is probably the best available solution.
Hi, Ben. I have two questions. I guess one of my questions pertains to the conservative movement in Canada. What do you think of Andrew Scheer and Bernie? And I guess my second question is, any thoughts on religious freedom, I guess in terms of its direction? How do you think it's going in not just the States and Canada, but North America in general?
Well, I mean, in the United States, it's going like garbage, religious freedom. That's because there's been an overt attempt to quash religious freedom in the name particularly of anti-discrimination law. And that's mainly a generalized attempt to quash broader freedoms, like in the United States, freedom of association and freedom of speech. So the idea there is that I can tell your religious school how to operate, I can tell your synagogue how to operate or your church how to operate, and that is a basic violation of religious freedom. I can tell your business how to operate, I can tell you how to operate your business in violation of your own religious precepts. I think that violates certain fundamental principles of being free. And that holds, look, what freedom really is about is your freedom to do stuff I don't like. It's not really called freedom if you're just doing a bunch of stuff that I like. Right? Because then it's just called stuff I like. And then if I'm the dictator, then I get to tell you exactly what it is you should do, and then we all agree on what you should do because you all agree with me, so everybody's happy. Okay, dictatorships usually aren't happy because freedom is premised on the idea you're going to do a bunch of stuff I'm not real fond of and that I have to just deal with it. Unfortunately, that is a perspective that seems to be going by the wayside in a lot of areas. Your first question was about, what, Bernie Sanders?
No, of course not.
I'm sorry?
My question is about the conservatives in Canada. Andrew Scheer, Maxime Bernier.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
When you say Bernie, we Americans, we automatically go to the Larry David-looking fella.
But yeah, any thoughts on them?
No, I haven't studied enough. I wish I knew more. I don't.
Thank you.
Hey, Ben. I have a question about Rwanda for you today. So in Rwanda, less than 25 years ago, 800,000 mostly ethnic Tutsis were murdered not by the government, but by their neighbors. Since then, Rwanda has improved remarkably, but in the process has favored forgiveness over justice and safety over journalistic freedom. How does Rwanda recover while still moving towards Western liberalism, and what should the U.S. have done during the buildup and culmination of the genocide?
Ooh, okay. So, again, I'm going to plead a certain level of ignorance because I'm certainly not an expert on Rwandan politics. Suffice it to say that the government of Rwanda remains a tyrannical dictatorship. There are a couple of very good books on this. One was recommended to me by my friend Jane Costin, who's of the left. The basic problem in Rwanda is that the genocide is used very often as a club by the dictatorship in order to curb journalistic freedom. If we let you look around and perform journalism, then you're going to reopen all of these old wounds, or you're going to undermine the government, which leads to chaos, which leads to renewed genocide. That is obviously a serious problem. I would suggest the problems run extraordinarily deep in a society where neighbors literally picked up machetes and murdered 800,000 of each other within the course of, what, 2 months, 3 months? I don't know how to solve that overnight. I don't have solutions for everything. all I would say is that, you know, freedom obviously comes with responsibilities, and a culture that is not necessarily ready for freedom may not be best governed by freedom. I don't think democracy is an automatic graft. I don't think that you can take democracy, plunk it down in Afghanistan, and boom, it works. I don't think that's the way it works. I think it's an overly optimistic view of human nature.
And what should the United States have done during that period?
The United States always has to determine its own interests in these areas. How much of a sacrifice would it have had to make in order to prevent that genocide? I was 10 when it happened, so I don't remember it all that well. But the idea that the United States could have done more in order to intervene is probably the case. The United States did do more to intervene during the Kosovo War by using air power to prevent a furthering of the genocide in Kosovo. I'm sorry? Okay, that's what I said. But the situation in Rwanda, it seems to me that, you know, again, I wasn't in the decision maker seat, and I wouldn't want to speak out of turn, but the use of American air power might have been more necessary than was used at the time.
Cheers.
Hi, Ben. Do you think extreme partisanship and political polarization between the Democrats and the Republicans are detrimental to the democracy? And in your opinion, what is the best way for Congress and society to reach a consensus on controversial issues in terms of gun control, same-sex marriage, and abortion?
So, number one, I don't think the consensus is what the American government was built for. It was built for competing interests fighting against each other and creating a certain level of gridlock. As far as gun control, that's not a national issue, nor should it be one. Localism in government is, in my view, always significantly better than control from the top down. I don't think Congress should really be involved in those issues. It seems to me that local governments are best situated to analyze whether gun control is necessary. I don't believe in gun control as a general principle. When it comes to same-sex marriage, I've been libertarian on this. I don't think the government should be involved in marriage at all. I think that the government has no business in how people behave in their personal life. And as a religious person, well, I religiously oppose same-sex marriage. Who cares? Right? If you want to go to a church and get same-sex married, more power to you. You don't have to care what I think. And I don't have to care what you think. Welcome to a free society. So, abortion, I think, is a little bit of a different issue because I believe that the Constitution was constructed to protect life, liberty, and property. Life is one of the life, liberty, and property.
I respect your answer, and I think we all respect the Constitution, we respect the law. But however, I also want to point out that there are some aspects of law that may not be good for people in general. And the reason why I say this is because laws are enacted by people, and people make the law, and usually it's the eloquent people who make the law. For example, if you have a debate with Piers Morgan, then I believe that you're going to arrive at a conclusion which everybody believes. So my question is, we all recognize the importance of free speech. Wouldn't it be unfair if one side of the political spectrum have a lot of eloquent debaters and persuasive speakers? For example, Republicans are better off with people like Jordan Peterson, Ben yourself, and Piers Morgan. So, do you agree with that?
Do I think that Jordan and I are better debaters than Piers? Yeah.
I understand. That's sarcastic.
But I mean, I will say this about the United States Constitution. It's not just, to me, a form of, you know, legal creation. It's based on certain underlying principles. Every law is based on certain underlying principles. I think that the underlying principles that were meant to be preserved by the Constitution of the United States are eternal truths. I think that the ambition of human beings is an eternal truth. I think the fact that we are better governed locally than we are nationally is an eternal truth. I think that the idea that you have individual rights that were given to you by nature or God in the view of the founders, those are eternal truths. And so designing a system based on those fundamental premises is more likely to arrive at a proper conclusion than basing a system on the idea that the community's rights outweigh the individual's rights, for example, which is sort of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man or the South African Constitution, by contrast.
Hello, Ben. Tonight I want to ask you about emotionalism and in particular fear. I believe in freedom, and I believe fear is the antithesis and can be compared to a panopticon of the mind. For example, my father, Barry Neufeld, has taken a stand against Soji 123, and rather than debate his stance rationally, the BC Teachers Federation and Canadian Union of Public Employees have opted for the fast track to Section 318, hate speech code, and sue him into silence, a move I believe is motivated by fear and goes far beyond casual conversation. What can individuals and communities do to combat creeping emotionalism and restore conscientious reason to discourse in this country?
Well, I mean, I think that the first thing that has to be done is there does have to be a mass movement against the use of the government gun to silence people that you don't like talking to. Okay, that has to stop. And it's why I opened the speech by ripping into the BC Human Rights Code. I don't like hateful speech any more than anybody else does, but I am not willing to give the government the power to shut down speech that I find offensive or hateful simply because I don't like it. The other thing we have to do is we have to acknowledge, look, speech is linked with action, otherwise no one would care what anybody else had to say. But to equate speech with violence, which is really what so many members of the left have done these days. If I make an argument, that means that you now have to go running to the sexual assault center because somehow I've assaulted you. It's nonsense, and it's counterproductive, and it leads specifically to the argument that because my speech is violence, you can use violence to silence my speech. Speech and violence are completely different. And unless you are openly inciting violence against somebody, your speech ought to be legal.
Last night you mentioned the Cartesian duality, and that piqued my interest, and it has me thinking how much do you think this is a problem? How much do you think that's linked to actual mental illness?
So, I mean, the argument that I was making last night, I spoke last night at Vancouver Hebrew Academy, and I was talking about, somebody asked a question about transgenderism, even though the speech was about anti-Semitism. And I was talking about this bizarre idea that you have a female mind inside of a male body. And I suggested that this was a kind of reversion to Cartesian duality, this idea of the ghost in the machine, that your mind exists separate from your body and that your body has nothing to do with your mind and your genetics and your brain workings have nothing to do with who you are as a person. And therefore, you know, you can create weird TV shows about people switching minds. Everything is Freaky Friday. And it seems to me that a lot of what is being argued right now, which is that the mind is completely separate from the body, and therefore all you have to do is change the body to meet what the mind wants it to be, is rooted in certain illogical precepts about what biology is and what reality is. And again, it's gut-churning to talk about these sorts of topics publicly, particularly when, you know, you're hurting people's feelings. Like, I actually, as much as I don't care about people's feelings, I actually kind of do. Like, I don't spend a lot of time talking about people's feelings because I feel like people use their feelings as a way to shut down debate. But the last thing that I want to do is to have people walking out really upset about things. Right? I think that's why I prefer a society in which we all grow a thicker skin. But it is true that a movement back to a sort of nearly pagan association with subjective truth is not good for anybody, including folks who are suffering from mental disorders.
Hey, Ben. I'd like to preface this with around about 50-50 with your opinions in terms of what I agree with and disagree with, but I've heard a good statement that says that there's rarely black or white in these situations of broad policy, whether it involves a body count or not. So what I wanted to ask you is that you've stated that it's our generation that tends to have these extreme views and how that forms the sub-adult culture in terms of maturity and whatnot. And I wanted to ask you, why in particular do you think it's the West Coast? Because there's a blue-red divide all over the United States. Why in particular do you think it's on this coast that this hotbed of extremist left diaspora, for lack of a better word, has formed?
Well, I mean, I think that as a lifelong resident of California, there's an echo chamber that's formed, and the only acceptable opinions are the ones that are to the left of the echo chamber. So I think that America as a broad whole has moved to the left. I think that's true in most other westernized countries as well, and that's most extreme and most pronounced in areas where you basically have one-party rule, which is what you have in places like California, and where kids are essentially indoctrinated in certain principles of leftism in public schools and by the entertainment complex that exists in Hollywood. So, you know, I do think that, you know, the society is moving ever further to the left. You know, I wouldn't say that our generation is particularly disconnected from reality. I think the baby boomers are pretty disconnected from reality. I mean, the baby boomers, I think, pretty much ruined America. So, I mean, they basically bankrupted the country and then made all of us pay for it and my kids pay for it, and then suggested that they've saved the country by creating all these social programs that are going to never be paid for under any circumstance, and then screaming and yelling whenever we talk about the necessary measures to cut them. So I'm not particularly fond of the generation that brought us the 1960s. Basically, there were a couple of things that were good about the 1960s, and they were very good, right? The civil rights movement was a wonderful thing about the 1960s. The first wave feminist movement was really earlier than the 1960s. There were some good things about the 1960s. As an overall thing, aside from the civil rights movement, they really sucked. They were not good for the country.
As a follow-up then, red or blue in the government, what actions do you think that the ruling party could take to avoid this delay in adulthood that's present among the current
generation? Well, I mean, I think the first thing is you have to make people not dependent on the government into adulthood. Right? We are not demanding anything of anybody until the point that they're 28, 29, 30 years old, and then we're acting like they're victims up till the point that they're 28, 29, 30 years old. Oh my God, you graduated from college with a gender studies degree and you can't get a $100,000 job. No shit, Sherlock. We're teaching folks, and this is true for politicians are in the business of lying to you, and the common lie that they are fond of telling you is that they are going to solve all of your problems. No politician has ever or will ever solve all of your problems or even a minute fraction of your problems. And you're seeing this from left and right. It drives me up a wall. People say, oh, well, you know, you're living in a town. Your economy's dying in this town. I'm going to come and I'm going to save your town. Nonsense. That person is not going to save your town. They just want your vote, and they're going to lie to you until they get your vote. Okay? The only way that your town is going to be saved is if you become an entrepreneur and you create jobs. You, not the government. Okay? The only way that you are going to have a nice family is if you make good decisions about dating and marriage and having children. The only way that you are going to have a nice career is if you make solid decision after solid decision, a chain of solid decisions about what you decide to major in, what job you decide to take, whether to quit that job for an apprenticeship in a different field, whether you're willing to move. Right? We spend so much time in politics talking about the society in which we bathe, in which we simmer, how that society is unjust and how it's not good and it's crushing us and all of these things. Yeah, the reality, again, for the 1,000th time, is that if you want to have a good life, look in the mirror first, then start worrying about everybody else.
Hey, Ben, big fan. I just want to say quickly, I really appreciate your approach to politics, and it means a lot more about discussion. It makes it better, especially for people who the left hate, especially white, straight, Christian, male conservatives, like myself. Just a question on your stance of evolution. I was just wondering, as a Christian, obviously I was raised a lot. Evolution and Christianity was the big debates for my social circles, and I was just wondering if you... spent a lot of time looking at young earth creationist theories, like from Christian ministries
I've spent
in the States.
Some time, because there's some of that in the Orthodox Jewish community as well. I don't believe any of it.
Okay, all right.
I believe that the earth is billions of years old, and that life is hundreds of millions of years old, and that human beings have been around for hundreds of thousands of years in modern form. And I believe in the generalized theory of evolution, although I believe in punctuated equilibrium, which tends to fit better with the sort of fossil record than the idea of a continuous evolution that occurred at a constant rate across time, which even Darwin didn't really argue for. And by the way, I think all of this is squarable with the Bible. I don't actually think that you have to... I think that God speaks the language of people. And so if you're a Bible believer, as I am, and as many Christians are, I don't see why you would think that, for example, young earth creationism assumes that when it says 6 days in the Bible, it means six literal 24-hour days. I don't know why you'd have to read it that way, considering that the sun is not created on day one. It says the first day. Well, what's a day in a world where there's no sun and where the earth doesn't revolve around that sun? There are some good books on this. There's one by Gerald Schroeder that I'm particularly fond of, called Genesis and the Big Bang, that's kind of fun to read. I don't think that you have to leave science at the door because you're a Bible believer. I'm a believer, as Maimonides was and as Thomas Aquinas was, that God speaks in a couple of different languages. He speaks the language of scientific truth, and he speaks the language of the Bible, and if you're not scoring them properly, that's your fault, not his.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Would you ever debate someone like Ken Ham, who believes that young earth theory, on like say a Sunday special or something like that?
I mean, I'd be happy to have him on. I'm always happy to have conversations with anybody. If I felt I didn't have the proper expertise to argue that point, I'd probably want to bring on somebody who's more of an expert in evolutionary theory to talk to Ken Ham. I think it'd be a better debate if now, like, the Sunday specials are really for me to ask questions like an ignoramus, that's what's fun for me, is that they're a place for me to learn. But if it were to be a debate on those things, what I'd really want to do is have back-to-back Sunday specials with, like, him and then Richard Dawkins, for example.
Really last question, just a fun one. Do you...
No, that's... We got to move on.
Do you sleep with the yarmulke?
I'm sorry?
Do you sleep with the yarmulke on your head?
No. Jews don't sleep with the yarmulke on their head.
Hi, Ben. I'm a big fan of yours. And at the meet and greet, I told you I've watched all your shows and
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
So this question, I know no one's asked you yet, because it's a relatively new phenomenon. But to preface before we get on to the question, you've mentioned before, to which I agree to, that the women back in the days, more with the Christian values and Judeo-Christian values, that they've realized men act a certain way. Therefore, we should take preemptive measures so that men don't act that way because we know how they act. Whereas the new third wave feminist movement sees men and says, well, if men act that way, therefore women can act that way as well. So what this is leading to is the new phenomenon is the slut walk movement. I don't know if you've known about that.
Yeah.
With Amber Rose. Yeah, so I'm just wondering, what do you think are the ramifications of women saying, well, if men can go out and dress however they want and women can do the exact same thing, do you think that leads to a loosening of the fabric of society
where shame is
a necessary determinant in society?
Yeah,
And that it leads to like sexual assault and increase in things?
Okay, so I think that, first of all, if somebody commits a sexual assault, the only person to blame is the person who commits the sexual assault, right? That right off the bat. Mm-hmm. Right? Victims are not to blame for their own sexual assault. I also think that if you put yourself in a risky situation, then you've put yourself in a risky situation,
mm-hmm.
right? We do this every day, right? Every day we make decisions about what sort of situations to put ourselves in. If I walk through a high crime neighborhood waving $100 bills above my head and then I am robbed, then it is the fault of the person who robs me. It is not my fault,
mm-hmm.
but I also made a bad decision to do that.
Yes.
Okay, so two things can be true at once.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not blaming the victim to say that it's a bad decision to walk through a high crime neighborhood at night waving your wallet over your head.
Yeah.
Right? It is also not a good idea to go to parties where drinking and drugs are commonplace mm-hmm. with a bunch of guys who are pigs.
Yes.
Right? That's just not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that relieve responsibility from the guys? 100% not. If a guy rapes you or sexually assaults you, he should be castrated or killed.
Yeah.
I'm very strict on this.
Absolutely.
But,
and one more question.
One of the things that I hate so much about this conversation is that people assume two things can't be true at once. That if I think that rape is bad, and I also think that you shouldn't make decisions that heighten your own risk factor, that mm-hmm. I'm somehow blaming the person who heightened the risk factor for the bad thing that happened to them. Yeah. No, two things can always be true at once, and normally they are.
Yeah, I just think the slut walk's increasing the sexual liberation.
You know, as far as slut
much.
Walk, again, I don't know why anybody would be prideful about their own promiscuity, man or woman.
Yeah.
It's confusing to me. As somebody who is a virgin until marriage, and very proudly so, uh-huh. and believe that has made my relationship with my wife better and
yeah.
stronger and holier, I am perfectly consistent on this. I hold women to a particular standard. I hold men to a particular standard. That standard is being classy.
Yeah.
I know that word has kind of lost some of its meaning these days, but
yeah.
being classy.
And one thing, Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks, he says that the Politicon debate that you were with, he says that it wasn't a real debate because debating you was like debating with a robot. So, and he preferred Tucker Carlson's debate. How do you respond to Cenk?
I mean, he preferred Tucker Carlson's debate because he and Tucker agree on more things. I mean, really, that's not a rip on Tucker. He and Tucker agree on all this stuff about corporations need to be restricted, and Tucker's more of an economic populist, and cut out campaign spending, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, if he doesn't like debating me, that's his prerogative. He agreed to it. I mean, as far as debating a robot, like, I'm sorry, I'm good at my job.
Hi, Ben. I am a liberal, but I'm a big fan of yours. I really appreciate the way that you talk and articulate yourself. The reason I bring that up being one thing that I've noticed that I'm not a huge fan of just in the political world is the sort of increased divisiveness between the left and right.
Yep.
So I'm wondering, what are some things about liberalism and liberals that you would admire?
So a couple of things. One, I make a very strong distinction between people who are leftists and people who are liberals when it comes to issues of free speech. So I admire folks like you who are willing to come out and actually listen to the other side and have conversations and debates. And you deserve a hand for that. And by the way, this is why, you know, it upsets me when folks walk out. So does the person who came in and asked about the transgenderism question. Anybody who comes and disagrees deserves enormous credit for coming to a room where they know they're going to be in the minority viewpoint-wise. That person, I feel bad the person's not here to receive a hand. That person should receive a hand. So that's number one. Number two, I think that the liberal concern with fairness is coming from a good place, although I think the policy ramifications of that concern are very often wrong. And I think that if you don't have that conversation constantly being had, then it could be easy to lose yourself in sort of the realm of anarcho-libertarianism. I think it's a reminder. Look, my view is, when it comes to my own family, I'm a liberal. Okay, why? Because my own family, we have income redistribution. I have a joint bank account with my wife, right? It's a paternalistic society because I'm literally the paterfamilia. I literally am the head of my family. And so that means that, you know, I admire some of the sentiments that back this. I don't think they're applicable to government. I don't think they're applicable to broader social strata. But they're a reminder that if you don't actually do the hard work of building up a social fabric at home and being kind to the people around you in your community, then there will be a call for that to be crammed down on you from above.
Hey, Ben. I'm a huge fan. Thank you for coming here. So I kind of wanted to, I was thinking about this question on the way in, and I knew it was going to be a contentious one for you. I just wanted to ask you a question about your best friend, Milo Yiannopoulos. So I know you guys have a lot of history, I'll say blatantly, but I was thinking about this a lot, and I know that I pay a lot of attention to Milo. I'm kind of a big fan of his too, so I mean, I'm sorry about that.
You really even like the tooth caps and all that?
I mean, I wasn't down with the veneers and the butt injections. I thought he was beautiful before then. So I mean, but no, I really, I'll get to my question. So I know you guys are really, really split, and he said some horrible things about you, and vice versa, maybe.
Not quite the same.
No, but I was kind of wondering.
I said he's not a conservative, and he sent me a picture of a black child on the day of my son's birth. So
I know,
no, not
I
quite
know,
the same.
I know. But my point is that, like, conservative speakers like yourself, like, there's the intellectual dark web. There's a group of you guys that kind of, you know, help bolster each other up. And I know that he's not necessarily a part of that. But I was wondering if people in general could see that someone like yourself is willing to extend an olive branch of some sort, and this is, like, totally hypothetical.
Well, here's the olive branch that I extended to Milo. And I will say this. I don't feel the need to extend an olive branch to somebody who sends me pictures of black children on the day my son is born. But the olive branch that I extend to Milo is the same olive branch that I extend to anyone with whom I have significant disagreement. When he was banned from Twitter, I said he shouldn't have been. And that's even though a lot of the Twitter trolls I was receiving who were sending me anti-Semitic memes on a fairly frequent basis were Milo fans. So, you know, I think that, you know, if Milo, you know, I don't believe that people should generally be banned from social media platforms. I think Milo said a lot of really terrible things. And I think that he has been a detriment to the conservative movement by linking the conservative movement with a lot of very bad ideas. Now, does that mean everything that he's ever said is bad? No. I mean, there are some things that he has said about political correctness with which I generally agree. My biggest problem with Milo, and this was my problem before he imploded, right? My biggest problem with Milo, we had this argument even before he went kind of full alt-right or alt-light or whatever he wants to call himself. My biggest problem with him was in, like, early March 2016 when he suggested that the future of America was not conservatism and not constitutional conservatism. It was a new big government populism that was going to take over where that left off. And I fundamentally disagreed with that. And he added that he thought that basically, being politically incorrect was the same thing as being an asshole. I don't think those two things are the same. I think you can be politically correct, which is to say you say valuable things that people find unpalatable, but they are actually valuable. They are arguments that need to be made, and be politically incorrect. That's not the same thing as somebody dropping the N-word or somebody dropping a slur or somebody, you know, doing what Milo was doing and showing pictures of actual transgender people on screens and mocking them for the crowd. Right? Like, I don't think that's necessary. I think you can make a fully cogent argument about what transgenderism is or what we ought to do as a society about sexual differentiation without doing that sort of thing. I think that it actually lends a lot of credence to the other side, which is politically correct in cracking down on free speech when you conflate those two things, when you conflate incivility or being a jerk with being politically incorrect. So those are my main problems with Milo. As far as, like, having a conversation with Milo, again, I don't really see the need because I don't see the productivity. I don't have conversations with a lot of folks. But I also don't think Milo should be banned, and I've never called for him to be so. In fact, I've openly called, even when we were, you know, even when this was at its worst, I said that he should not be banned from Twitter.
Hey, Ben, big fan of yours, first of all, and the question that I have for you is, you're kind of guilty of it a little bit, and most of the Americans are. My background is originally, I came from Russia, and my stance is, for example, in the debate that you brought up was Rwanda. Why does America have to have a stance on everything, and why does America have to actually go into a country and potentially prevent a genocide or something like that? Why does America have to be involved in all the world's affairs?
So America doesn't. The answer is America does not. But there's a good argument to be made that if you can help, you do. So if it's a very little cost to the United States to send a few bombers over a particular area to stop a million people from being killed, then is that worth the sacrifice? I believe yes, because I believe that the United States is an empire of liberty and that when you show that liberty to the world, that is a good force for the United States. Does that mean we should be involved interminably in every conflict? No. Every single conflict, you have to make a cost-benefit analysis about what is worthwhile and what is not. But does morality play a role in American foreign policy? Sure. I mean, I think that it does. But again, it has to be done on a case-by-case basis, which is why foreign policy is so murky and why you see a lot of folks who are isolationists before they take office suddenly becoming non-isolationists as soon as they're in office. You see Barack Obama arguing the war in Iraq is something we totally shouldn't get involved in, and suddenly we're bombing Libya. And you see Donald Trump saying the war in Iraq was the biggest disaster in American foreign policy history, and suddenly we're bombing Syria. right? It's easy to be isolationist in a vacuum or to be interventionist in a vacuum. It's a very different thing when the chips are down.
Hey, Ben. My name is Mitch. I was just wondering, going to ask you a question about this whole media issue going on today, where you see easily people on Fox News like Laura Ingraham get called out for saying LeBron has to shut up and dribble, when yet on what I call the left wing, even though they claim their objective, CNN, where you have guys like Don Lemon saying, you know, this is kind of what happens with Kanye when
right.
black folk don't read, and
right.
blaming Trump and Trump supporters for even possibly this bombing packages and the synagogue shooting, and yet everyone kind of sees it, hears it, and kind of goes, you know. But as soon as someone like on the right, like Laura Ingraham,
yeah.
would say something like that, it's like, oh, she should be boycotted, protested, stepped down, fired, all
right.
this type of stuff. I was just wondering, like, is there any way for people to maybe call out people on the left media more often?
Yeah, I think we do it on a regular basis in the right-wing media. The left is constantly looking for excuses to silence, and they've been on Laura's trail for a long time. They've done the same thing to Mark Levin. They've done the same thing to Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and everybody else. I'm sure they'll do it to me. It comes for everybody. And then the question is whether it's legit or not. Almost universally, it is not. One of the great irritants, I mean, I did my entire episode today on my show about this. One of the great irritants that I see right now, and something that is making people crazy, is the gaslighting, where you see that they'll call out rhetoric on one side, but they won't call out rhetoric on the other side. And this cropped up its ugly head with regard to anti-Semitism or violent rhetoric, where they'll say, well, President Trump is responsible for violent rhetoric, and that's what caused what happened in Pittsburgh. And then they'll turn around and you say, well, and Don Lemon will literally get on TV and say on national television, you've never seen a Democrat shoot anybody. And Steve Scalise is over here going, hello, right? Like the fact is that the inability to objectively measure the facts because you don't want to look your own side in the face is not good for politics. It does happen on both sides. I think these days it happens a lot more frequently on the left than on the right.
Hi, Ben. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate what you do. And you're the main reason that I got into politics.
Well, thank you.
For your Thug Life compilations. my question is to do with the Conservative Party of Canada and just conservatives in general kind of caving in on a lot of views, such as abortion and, I don't know, other ones. and kind of saying that we need to get votes and kind of caving in on views just to get votes and cater to society, for example, to like get Justin Trudeau out of power. So I just want to know what your thoughts on that is.
Well, I mean, we've had similar problems in the United States. I'll speak to the analog. Quick note on Justin Trudeau. Handsome Bernie Sanders does not qualify you to be prime minister of a country. As I said last night, like, I'm real happy he's got a six-pack and all. But I do not understand what that has to do with knowing a single thing about governance. As far as political parties caving on particular hot button issues, I'm never in favor of abandoning eternal truths for temporary political gain. It doesn't seem to work out well, because all that happens is that the country continues to move left, and soon you're abandoning more ground and more ground and more ground. That's particularly true on the life issue. There are certain issues where I feel like a consensus can sort of be reached. I'll take an example, same-sex marriage. So, as I said, I was an advocate, still am an advocate, of traditional marriage. I don't believe that same-sex marriage has the same societal benefit as heterosexual marriage because of biology. Right? That's not to say that I don't think that gay people can't live together in happiness. That's fine. But if you're talking about what benefits society, well, marriage was always built around bearing and rearing of children, which obviously is going to be a lot more common in heterosexual couples than in homosexual couples. With that said, it appeared to me that what was happening in the United States, that the ground was shifting, and folks wanted the government to become the great imprimatur of virtue. And so now the government was going to grant same-sex marriage. And my response to that was, here's a better idea. Why don't we just all get out of this business? Right? And that's something that I think can make everybody happy, because when the government gets out of everybody's business, we all tend to be a little bit happier. And then if you want to do what you want to do at your church, totally fine. Is that me abandoning the traditional marriage issue? No, it's me acknowledging that the government is not good in a particular area and that the social fabric has to be rebuilt in a particular area and that the social fabric has to be protected by getting government out of that realm entirely. I've said the same thing with regard to things like marijuana legalization or decriminalization. I've never smoked pot in my life. I find it irritating. It smells terrible. But with that said, the government sucks at regulating it, at least in the United States. And so that means that maybe the solution is deregulation or decriminalization of marijuana, specifically with the goal of allowing to find a certain market level, and then allowing a social fabric to be built around the idea that maybe smoking pot is bad, as opposed to it just being, basically, here's my view. If the government is the last repository of virtue, there is no last repository of virtue. The government is never going to be the great guarantor of decency or virtue. There has to be something undergirding it, or the government has nothing to stand on.
Hi, Ben. I actually did come dressed as Elizabeth Warren today, so. I'm a divorced mom with four children, and because of personal tragedies in my life, I'm raising two boys who have a distinct lack of positive male role models in their life. And I'm wondering, what can women in my situation do to foster a sense of positive male identity in this climate of toxic anti-man hate?
I mean, I do think it's a great question. And good for you for, number one, good for you for worrying about that issue, because there are too many people who don't. I think that you have to make an active attempt to find people who you think are good positive male role models and put them in your son's life. And I think this is true, by the way, even if it were a two-parent family. You want to surround your kids with good people who can have a good influence on them. There's a fascinating study about single motherhood in the United States, and what it actually showed is that the single best predictor of whether somebody was going to succeed or fail was not single motherhood per se. It was actually the number of single moms in a particular area, meaning that if you could find a surrogate father figures, then you did okay. If you were living in a heavily married area where there are a lot of men around to model particular behavior, you did okay. So, you know, there's certain areas of life that male father figures still predominate. Sports is obviously a big one. Religious institutions are obviously another big one. I don't know whether grandparents are in the picture. Grandfather's in the picture. You can back the mic for a second.
No, my father recently passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry
to hear
that.
And their paternal grandfather lives 6 hours away.
Would he be, and moving's not a possibility? And he's not, like...
That side of the family name calls a lot. They call the kids retards, stupid.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah.
But... what I would suggest is, I mean, are there men in your life who you feel would make for good role models?
Well, in my church, we don't, at the ages my kids are at, they're not around a lot of men, but we have male missionaries. They're 19 to like in their early 20s. So I have them over for dinner twice a month, and I try my best.
Be involved in any of these groups where they're around other men who can provide a good example for them?
I have been trying to get men into the children's organization that they currently go to activities for, and it looks like we will be getting some male leaders there.
Oh, that's great. Well, so I mean, I think that the fact that you're even thinking about it means that your sons will be okay, because if you continue to seek this out, you will find it.
Okay.
I think the bottom line is good for you. I mean, because again, if... because being proactive in seeking good male role models is absolutely vital for them. So again, I have nothing but praise for you. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
So my question is, I've seen a lot of conversations break down because of differences in the importance placed on action and intent, like focusing on what someone has said and not what they mean. My question is the following: when is it necessary to take someone's intentions into account, and when are their actions all that need to be considered?
Okay, so... my general rule, and this is something I've tried to work on also, I think we all should try and work on it, so I'm not going to, you know, exempt myself from this category because I've made mistakes along these lines. There's a Jewish principle called Dan Lekaf Schus. What it means is that you're supposed to try and see everybody in the most favorable possible light. So when somebody says something and it has two possible interpretations, do you see it in the worst available light, the one that makes them look the most racist, the most terrible, the most sexist, the most bigoted, or do you try to read it in the light where, you know, maybe that's not what they actually meant? And when you try to view people like that, you're likely to have better conversations than when you immediately go to the character attack, which is the easier place to go and the more cynical place to go. That I think is the place where intent matters. Where intent does not matter is when somebody actually takes an action to hurt another human being, then intent does not matter at that point. And if a person does it repeatedly, then intent certainly doesn't matter. If it's an accident, that's one thing. But if you're pursuing a policy publicly that has the same impact over and over and over and over, and you keep going for this policy over and over and over and over, at a certain point, I can't grant you that sort of license of good intent. At a certain point, your intent doesn't matter anymore. At a certain point, negligence becomes purpose. And you know, that I think requires repeated action. Also require, we have to discuss the severity of the action being taken. So first rule of thumb, try to treat people, you know, with the best of intent. Second rule of thumb, it's not always possible. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Shapiro.